We're going to go over to the book of Esther. We I won't read the whole thing. What, 9 chapters? And actually 10. So the last one's only got 3 verses in it. 10 chapters. So let's just start. We're going to give you some background information. I'm going to retell a story and then we'll go back over it again. I'm not going to read the whole thing, and the reason I keep saying that is because in Hebrew, in rabbinical writing, and if you go to a synagogue, they don't refer to this as the book of Esther. They refer to it as the Megillah. And for years, when they first started reading the book of Esther or the Megillah, they didn't know whether what portions to read or whether to read the whole book. And this was a debate for a long time. And so finally, and this is the official ruling, when they have the Feast of Purim, which is based on this book of Esther, I've never really talked about it too much. The Feast of Purim, the word Purim means lot. Actually, it means like a throw of the dice. Because of this book, they were going to kill the Jews, and the day was selected on what day to kill the Jews in the Persian Empire, and it was done by a throw of the dice. So Purim means casting a lot, or throw of the dice. So this is our gambling book. We should have read it Friday night. But that's how they selected. Yeah, I went to Cheeseburger in Paradise. It was my bookmarker this morning, the only thing I had close by. So that's where, and I don't know you younger people, you pups out there, if you remember, but I was raised in a family and I had one particular aunt who said this all the time. You've got to clean my house. The whole Megillah. Have you guys ever heard that saying? The whole Megillah. You've got to do the whole Megillah. And that's what it was referring to, is it came out of this debate over whether you should read the whole Megillah, the book of Esther, or just part of the Megillah. And so here's my family, good little Gentiles, not knowing what they're saying, and yet they're repeating what has been argued in rabbinical Jewish synagogues for centuries. Should we or should we not read the whole Megillah? Isn't that interesting? It is to me. Anyway, so this book of the Megillah, or this book of Esther, is a book that God himself is never mentioned in. Ever, ever, ever. He's never talked about. His name is not in there. About the only religious thing that you find in here is that at one point the Jewish people fast. And that's it. So it's really a secular book. And there were some people who said they didn't know if we should actually include this book. I think Martin Luther said he wished it was not, if he had his wishes, it would not be in the Bible because it didn't mention God. But I really believe that we can make a good case for, while this is a book all about secularness, that it just has the handprints of God all over it. You know, let me back up in the day when I used to work at Clay City. Yeah, that's a good phrase. I used to work over there. Well, I didn't work very hard over there. When I was over there pretending to attend to the business of the store. As most of you know, and I make no qualms about it, I was not a happy camper when I was over at that place, that particular establishment. I don't think I would have been happy anywhere in particular, probably at that time in my life. But right then, I was not happy being there doing what I was doing. And I was just chafing all the time, every day and every day and every day. And I did not see God in this whole thing. That's where this whole secular idea comes in, because that was my secular job. And I do remember going to work one day, Clay City, I was driving out of Noble, and I was just driving that way, and I was going, God, I just don't get it. I'm going over there. I don't even think you like me, let alone love me anymore. Why don't you just give me a sign that you're... Oh, come on, God. About that time, I round the corner coming down Route 250 out of Noble going toward Clay City. Right at the corner of 250 and 50 where they intersect, I stop. I'm headed west. The sun is rising in the east. This is no lie, folks. I wish I had a camera. I'm headed west. I pull up and I look, and the sun is hitting this cloud. It is awesome. But this cloud looked exactly like this. Now, I don't know if you know what that is. I mean, from the wrist up, you could see the fingers, you could see the thumb, the palm of the hand, the fluff, you know, the thicker part. Every detail of a hand was in this cloud, and it wasn't just fluffy like, you know, oh, that kind of looks like a goat or a bunny, or it could be a bear. Then again, it could, you know, it looked like a hand just like this. And if you don't know what this means, it's a sign that says, I, this is L, love, this is you, I love you. And I had just been saying, I said, God, why don't you just give me a sign that you care, that you love me or something, I've about had it over there. Turn the corner and this great big humongous hand is in the sky like this. Well, God's a literalist, yeah, that's so cool. You know, you can't just park there forever looking at a cloud. People think I'm crazy anyway. It was astounding. It was just astounding. You can throw it up to whatever you want. I don't care. It was God giving me a sign. I went like a happy person all the rest of that day. But true to form, signs do not stay. The cloud dispersed. My thrill of seeing the sign slowly faded away, and I went right back to my grumpy self. Being a grumpy person for years over there took its toll upon me until one day a person confronted me with the Word of God. It was a lady. And I was, because that is my day job. That's my secular job. And she says, have you acknowledged God in all your ways? And I said, yes, I have. She says, is our God sovereign? I said, yes, He is. She said, if you acknowledge the Lord in all thy ways, He will direct thy paths. He is sovereign. Where are you at? And I said, I'm in Clay City. And I'm not happy. She said, get over it. You've acknowledged Him. He's sovereign. That's where you are. That's where you're supposed to be. Just shut up. Quit grousing about it and let it go, because you are to be there and you will stay there. Do you remember that time I told you I had to learn to sing Rose of Sharon, and I sang it and sang it? You will stay in Clay City until you finally learn that lesson that you're to learn in Clay City. So the last few years of Clay City I actually got were... yeah, it was okay. I can't say it was the best 5 years of my life, but the last 5 years over there. But it was definitely a lot better than the first 15. And that's what this is about, is God is not mentioned in here per se, and it is a secular story, and yet it's got the fingerprints of God all over it, and we have got to realize that God is involved in our lives, whether we see Him or not, whether it is a religious holiday or festival or church time, or whether we're in a secular position. If we are Christians and we have acknowledged Him in all of our ways, He is influencing our life, working with us every step of the way. And even though He's not shouting from the ceilings at me, you know, hey Doyle, this is here and I'm, you're great, we're having, woohoo, hang in there, all this signs and wonders going on all the time in your secular life, it does not negate the fact that God is there. And it also is pointing to this. We are to walk by faith and not by sight. And even if it's a secular job or a secular setting, it is still, our God is sovereign and He's in control. And I believe that that's what this whole, one of the whole things about this book is teaching. Even though He's not mentioned, He is still the person who is behind moving all these pieces. And we standing out here reading this book go, oh yeah, we see that. And yet in our own lives, we don't see God is doing absolutely the same thing in our lives. We can be grumpy, we can be happy, but God is still sovereign, still moving parts and pieces. And if we realize that, we can walk with confidence. Now let me tell you the story of Esther so that we can go back and tell it again and give you more information besides just the word Megillah. Esther is, she's just a Jewish girl minding her own business. The king, whom I will say Xerxes, because that is who it is. Xerxes is the guy who was a Persian king who tried to invade Greece. The movie The 300, where the Spartans fight against the Persian king, Xerxes, he's the main player, the enemy in that story. And so if you want to go see the movie, you can. It's kind of, But anyway, so that's the historical setting. He is a historical person. Xerxes is having a party. He invites all the main people, all of his princes, all the viziers, all the great advisors. Advisors, that's where that comes from. All his advisors together. They're having a big bash. His wife, Vashti, is over in another part of the palace complex. She's invited all the ladies whose men are over at that party, and she's having a party of her own. She invites them, and they're having their party. The king says, go get Vashti and bring her over here, because she is really good looking and I want the people to see how good looking she is. She was drop dead gorgeous. Ladies, you don't understand. Guys, you will. I will confess, there has been one lady in my life who was drop dead gorgeous. I was a young guy walking down the streets of Chicago, being holy and all that stuff, and I came around this corner and there she stood. Oh my gosh, was she good looking. Drop dead gorgeous, and I'm just walking down the street. And it's just like America's Funniest Home Video. Wham, right into a parking meter. Boom! I'm like, oh gee, I hope she didn't see this. But, you know, I'm like, I don't even have a common... What I do is go... Get to the edge of the building, run as fast as I can all the way around the block, come back, pretending I'm my twin brother so I can get one more look at her. She was beautiful. I would have made the third trip around the block, but she was getting into a big limousine. Oh, darn the luck. And true, I almost stumbled into a few other things on the second time around. Drop dead gorgeous, she was a trophy. You could also tell she had attitude. Just like this lady, Vashti, she was that good looking, and because she was so good looking, she had the attitude of a supermodel, and she said, you tell him I ain't coming. You know, one of those, that just irritates me when somebody does that head bobble thing. Anyway, that was her attitude, and she said, you tell that guy I'm not coming over there. Because she thought she was so hot that he wouldn't dump her. Of course, he gets ticked. He throws her out the door, sends her packing, kicks her to the curb, however you want to say it. He gets rid of her. I don't know what happened to that lady. I don't know if he just threw her out, if he pat her on the head, or if he had her executed. All I know is she was gone. He then tells his advisors, go out into all the lands, find the most beautiful, good-looking ladies, bring them back to me. They do it, they get them dressed, they go through the whole thing of feeding them, clothing them, getting them prepared to enter court life. They come through, finally he sees Esther, he likes Esther, he marries Esther, and then time goes on. Esther's married, she's now the queen. This guy, her uncle's named Mordecai, sets in the gateway, which is like courthouse, he sets in the courthouse gateways of the Emperor Xerxes, and he's passing judgment, and one time he saves the Emperor's life. And the Emperor makes a note and says, one of these days I'll reward you. He doesn't get around to it for quite a while. Haman, who is the bad guy, comes along, and he gets the Emperor to say, I want you to tell everybody, because I am one of your big shots, the vizier, I want you to have everybody to bow to me when I come into the palace. And so he'd ride through the gates and everybody's bowing to Haman, except Mordecai. He's standing there, I ain't going to do it. So he gets Miff, not Mordecai, but the other guy. He goes to the king and he says, you know, there's some people here that's really bad because he's going to get even with this guy. I'm going to get even with him. So he says, how about... Actually, his wife encourages him. How about this? And they go to he goes to the Emperor Xerxes and he says, there are some people out there who are bad, evil influences. Not very many, an insignificant group, but you know how it is. If they take root, that they will bring disaster and foment rebellion. And if you will let me, trust me, O great Emperor, I will make sure these people are eradicated. And the emperor says, well, if you say they're that bad, okay, get rid of them. He says, I will. So he hatches the plan to get rid of all the Jews. He throws the dice, picks the day because of the roll of the dice, says this is it, it's the 13th of Adar. Don't ask me when that is. Look it up on our calendar. It'll say Purim. If you're going through your calendar, that's when the 13th of Adar is. Adar could be. Anyway, so... he's ready to exterminate the people. He sends a message out and tells them that on this day, any person in the realm can kill a Jew and take whatever they own. So everybody else is like, woohoo! And they're going to get rich. Mordecai is mortified. He goes to his niece, who is now the queen, Esther. The king doesn't know she's Jewish because Mordecai said, don't tell them who you are. Just be cute, lovable. And he said, lady, we've got to do something. She says, he'll kill me because you're not allowed to enter the king's presence without being summoned. If he doesn't greet you with a smile and stick that golden scepter out towards you, they just haul you off and kill you. Mordecai basically says, lady, it's now or never. How do you know you weren't put in place for this? She said, fine, the people are praying and fasting. She goes to the king. She walks in. She says, he goes, ah, beautiful lady, come here. What do you want? She says, I'd like to invite you and Haman over to my place for a supper. He said, fine. They show up that night. They eat. I know you guys know this story, but we got to go through it all. They sit down. They eat. He says, finally, my dear, what is it you really want? She said, I'll tell you what. You come back tomorrow and I'll be ready to tell you. I just wanted to make sure that you were willing to hear me and I didn't want to offend you by asking you something. That was so clever because being a person who has had people work for me, I've had people as soon as they hit the door, crab, 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 and they work for me. They're good workers. They're clean. They're honest. Crab, 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 and you just want to shove a stock in their mouth, tape them up, and say, just work and shut up. And there has been a couple of them, I have looked them square in the eye and said, would you just shut up? I don't want to hear it from the time you hit the door to the time you're crabbing all the time. Just shut up. Oddly, they didn't take that very well. Go figure. You know, she was not that way. She waited till he greeted her. Hey, babe, come up here. What do you want? She waited till he said, what is it I can do for you? On the second feast, they're sitting there. Haman is so sure that he's in with the royal duo, that he is ready to go, that he has a scaffold built. And there's an interesting story in that too. He builds this scaffold. The next day they get there, the king wines and dines, and he says, now what is it you want? She says, there's somebody getting ready to kill my people. He said, who are you? Who is this and who are your people? She says, the enemy, the adversary, is that evil guy right there, Haman. And Haman just... and he looks at her, and he looks at him, and he looks at her, and she goes, I'm Jewish, he's wanting to kill me. He is so livid. Gets up, storms out into the garden. While he's out there, Haman realizes that his goose is cooked. He throws himself on at her mercy. And the king comes in, has a fit, and one of the advisors, a servant over there, says, oh, by the way, king, he built a big scaffold to kill her uncle Mordecai on the guy that saved your life. And And the king said, fine, hang him from that. Sent out a decree to all the Jews and said, you are able to take up arms and defend yourself. And a matter of fact, you can go to any armory within the empire. Before that day, select your weapons to do battle with anybody who tries to kill you. And Jews, if anybody attacks you and you kill them, you can take anything they have. Stalemate. It's all over with. She's great queen. Mordecai's lifted up. Yay, Mordecai. The other guy's dead. End of the book. Now, let me run through this again. When the Jewish people are doing this and they're reading the whole Megillah, they actually read this whole thing. Remember before I said that one of the worst insults you can do to somebody is to show them the bottom of your feet, to take your sandal off. Remember the guy threw it at President Bush over in Iraq the other day? Whenever they knocked down Saddam Hussein's big statue, you saw the people taking their sandals off and beating it. It was to show their utter disgust and contempt. Now, when they read this, you go to a Jewish synagogue, this is not a holy day, so they're not totally reverential. They actually are very, very, very noisy because the decree at the end of this is that his name would be obliterated, Haman's name, would be obliterated. So they honestly will write Haman on the bottom of their shoe. They have noisemakers like we have, you know, those and tambourines and anything that makes a racket. And when they read the whole Megillah to these people, every time Naaman's name comes up, everybody starts stomping their feet, making as much noise because they're obliterating his name so that even the walls of the synagogue cannot hear it. They make as much noise as they can and they boo and they hiss. It's very melodramatic. It's very, I'd like to go through it sometime because I think it'd be a hoot. They have just all sorts of things that they're supposed to do at this time. So they're going through this book, but now listen to what it says when we read it. Chapter 1, verse 7 through 11. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold. This is at that original party where the king Artaxerxes or Xerxes is serving. And he says, all and the royal wine was in abundance according to the state of the king, and the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officials of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vishta made a feast for all the women in the royal house which belonged to the king. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded, and gives big long names, the chamberlains that served in the presence of the king, Xerxes, to bring Vishta, the queen, before the king with the royal crown to show the people the princess, her beauty, for she was fair to look upon. Now, I think we should have meetings, board meetings, just like this. Because you see, this is a board meetings, what's going on here. They would gather all their viziers together and they would have a council meeting like war. What shall we do? How shall we run the empire? Well, I want to hear from everybody and get their input. Everybody would say, well, I think, and then the king would say, I think we ought to do this. And everybody would say, yeah, king, you're right. Way to go. Woo-hoo. Even though they knew it was the most stupid thing in the whole world and they wanted to say that, you did not cross the king. And the king knew that you did not cross the king. Because if you did, it was bound and determined it was his responsibility to kill you. But if you were an idol worshiper, this is a good board meeting. Because nobody wanted to offend the king, they'd say, well, now we're going to start drinking. And they would have a designated diners. That's what this, nobody was compelled, but the designated diners did not drink. Their job was to sit there and watch all the other people just get three sheets to the wind totally plastered. So they're drinking and imbibing because their God, by drinking the holy wine, would speak through them and give information. So the designated diners would sit there and listen as everybody else would get really ripped and they'd say, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard in my life, Emperor. How ignorant can you get? They would get away with this because it wasn't them speaking, it was the spirit of the wine god. And since they were all three sheets to the wind, the emperor himself did not remember everything that was going on. He was probably singing doo-wop songs. So he didn't remember what was going on, so he couldn't be personally offended by all this. The designated drivers, after the big bash was over with, would say, okay, now here's what the wine god said to all of us. And then they would take what was said there by these other people and compare it with what was said when they were all sober. And then they would actually truly decide what they should do based upon the drunken brawl truth that was said out loud and utterly, and the people who was very, I want to offend the king. And they would put it together, and then they'd make their decision on how to fight their battles. Hey, board, what do you think? I know that in my presence you don't want to offend me, but I think about five bottles of Manischewitz ought to loosen us up. It was a good idea, folks. I was willing to spring for the keg. We could have bingo. By the way, Jewish people are also teetotalers, for the most part. They will drink a little on Friday night, a glass of wine, but other than that, but on this one holiday, they get totally schnockered. The rabbis tell them to, because they're supposed to reenact this, and so it's okay if you just... So they're out there knocking these things back. So they were having this board meeting is what was going on and why it was done that way. Now, verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 17, we know that the queen gets knocked out, Vishta, and along comes this one. And the king, in verse 17, and the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vishta. There she is, folks. She has no royalty about her. She's not connected in any way. He just picks her out and says, oh my gosh, I love you. And he elevates her to a status, puts a crown on her head, and then we come along to the next part. Mordecai's done his thing. Chapter 3, verse 1. After these things did the king Xerxes promote Haman, the son of Hamadiah, the Agite, and advanced him and set him in a seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants at the gates bowed down, and that's where Mordecai refused to do it. Boo, Haman. Most of us read that and miss this one little point. Haman was the son of Hamadiah, the Agite. You guys ever heard of the Agite? Yeah! 1 Samuel chapter 15. You've got this guy named Saul, and God says, go out and do battles with the Amalekites. Wipe them all out off the face of the earth. Kill absolutely everyone, every person that comes along, including all their stock. Saul goes out, does battle, wins the day, but he keeps the choice of the herds, and he keeps this king named Agag. This guy, Haman, is a direct descendant of Agag. And according to rabbinical teaching, when Saul took the king, he gave him royal honors, which meant he got to travel with his entourage, even though he was defeated. And so he has his wife with him. And he meets Saul, and Saul says, what is all this bleeding of sheep and this noise? He said, oh, well, you know. He said, God told you to kill them all. He says, well, we was bringing them to sacrifice. He goes, what's this king doing here? He says, bring the king here, and he kills him in a very, very bad way because it uses an unusual word that's usually not used in Scripture. He killed the guy really, really bad several ways. He killed him. And according to the teaching, had he killed this man the day that he met him, he conceived of a son, and this guy, Haman, is the 16th generation from that guy there. Had the man followed God's instructions to the T, Haman would have never been in this position to attack the Jewish people to begin with. Lesson to learn, if God tells you to do it, you do it exactly like he says it. Follow it right down to the T, because you don't know what you're doing off in the future. Agag the Amalekite was a descendant of Esau's oldest son. But no, they wouldn't listen. So along comes the whole decree, the whole fighting, the whole grumpiness going on. Haman has cast his lot. He's ready to kill all the people. Chapter 5, verse 1, "Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house." It's just talking about she walked in one way and he's sitting there. She's put on her royal garments and she's standing there in front of him. She doesn't say a word. She just waits. He extends his hand forward and says, "Come here." She invites him over. Chapter 6, verse 12, verse 14. Remember, Haman's wife is the lady who helped him. She said, "Yes, kill Haman. You got to hang him." And Mordecai came again to the king's gate. This is chapter 6, verse 12. "But Haman hastened to his house mourning and having his head covered. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all of his friends everything that had befallen him," because the king ordered him to do homage to Mordecai. "Then as he sat with his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, because thou shalt surely fall before him." Basically, what she said is, "Guy, you are in so much trouble because you are attacking the Jews. Did not God say, they who bless you, I will bless. They who curse you, I will curse." She realizes who this is and she says, "You're falling before the Jews, you idiot. They're Jews. You shouldn't have touched them. They're blessed of God. They're Abraham's kids. You are going down." She just basically said, "Goodbye." Verse 7, or chapter 7, verse 5 through 6. "Then the king Artaxerxes answered and said unto Esther the queen, Who is he and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so? And Esther said, The adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen." Ooh, stomp, make noises. "And the king arising from the banquet of the wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And when Haman stood up to make a request for his life to Esther the queen, he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was." The bed is like a fainting couch. They recline to eat. She's laying on this fainting couch. He throws himself on the bed. "Then the king said, Will he force the queen also before me in my house? And the word went out of the king's mouth, and they covered Haman's face, and Haman gets hung on this scaffolding." What happened is the king is just in a rage. How dare his vizier put him in this position with his beloved queen? He walks out to the garden. When he comes back, this guy is throwing himself at the queen. He thinks something bad's about to happen, and he's going, "You what? In my house? You're dead." That's how it happened. And they take him out and kill him. Now, according to rabbinical teaching, Haman is trying to build a scaffold to hang Mordecai on. And this is rabbinical legend. Don't take too much stock in it. It's just interesting they tell his story. When he approaches different trees and says, "I want to make a scaffolding out of you," the tree would say, "Are you going to use me to kill Mordecai on?" He would say, "Yes." They would say, "I'll have no part of it, because that is an unclean thing that you're going to do, and I am a holy object before God." He goes around all the trees till finally he comes to the thorn tree, and that thorn tree has no compunction. He said, "I don't have any problem with it." So he uses a thorn tree to build the scaffold, because the thorn tree is a bad tree. Isn't it interesting that Jesus Christ, who becomes our sin, has a crown of thorns on his head? And that's how it plays out in rabbinical teaching, and that's why those crowns was put on his head, showing that the thorns were put there as a thing of total disgust, because Jesus bore our sins for us. And they looked upon that as saying, this is God's judgment, and total disgust against him because he's being treated like Haman. he is the adversary. Okay, now we're about at the end of it. And then we're back to chapter 4, where he says to her, "Lady, time's like this. That's why you're there." One more time through this, it won't take long. This is what it means to us. When we read this story, this is the understanding we should take from it. Most of us miss these points because it's not emphasized. She comes along, the king sees her, he loves her, and she does what? She obtains grace and favor from the king. At that moment, he makes her the queen. She obtains grace and favor. She does not understand it. She is still shy and embarrassed and actually afraid of the king, and her people are put in this situation. Her uncle says, "Let me explain this to you. You're put in this at this very time and place. Go to the king and ask him." She says, "No, he's liable to kill me." He says, "No, no, no. Go do it." She puts on her royal robes, her royal robes that were given to her, when you read that and the way it's supposed to be said. Those robes were given to her, not her own righteousness. When we were picked out by God and he looked upon us and he says, "I love that person," we obtain grace and favor just like she did. We don't always understand it, but we have it just as much. She didn't need to be afraid of that guy from that point on. She could have went anytime boldly before the king and just right up front said, "King, live forever. Here's the problem, dear. That guy wants to kill my people. I'd like you to do something about it." She pussyfooted around, but she still got the job done. But she went before the king and she put on those royal robes that was given to her. And we are given robes of righteousness by Jesus Christ. We are given the same kind of crown, a royal crown. We are in grace and favor by God, whether we understand it or not, and whether we take advantage of the situation and avail ourselves to this. Third, she went forward and she finally asked him. She said, "Dear, this is the problem. Here is the one thing that most of us has missed. Where was she when she asked?" She was on the couch, resting. There's Doyle back again, resting. She was in the presence of her enemy, in the presence of the king, and she was resting there in the presence of that enemy. She wasn't attacking him. She wasn't trying to kill him. All she said is, "You're my husband. You're my king. You're the one who watches over me. You're my Lord and Master. I need this favor from you." She's dressed in the royal robe. She's got the crown on. She's got grace. She's got favor. And she is at rest. And the king comes back and says, "What do you think you're doing?" And whoops up on him. God's ways are not our ways. We honestly a lot of times think, well, whenever we whip that enemy in our life, then we can rest. That is not what the Scripture teaches us. The Scripture teaches us to go before God, and it's not a bad way to approach Him. Put on those royal robes, walk into His presence, and just stand there and wait quietly until He looks upon you and says, "There you are. What can I do for you? I've got a problem. May I sit down?" "Yes, you may, my dear. Have a seat." And while you're resting, you say, "Here is the problem. That's my enemy." What are your enemies today? What does it say in the Psalm 23 that we all quote all the time? "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," blah, blah, blah. "And he sets a table before me in the presence of mine enemy." He didn't say that he wiped the enemy out and then he set this table of banqueting. The table of banqueting is set while your enemy is right there, right in your presence. You're in his presence. And this is a way of just absolutely proving to God we trust him. "God, here's my problems. Let me sit down here. Get totally relaxed. My enemies are around me. And I'm not going to worry about it. You're my God. You're my King. What can I do for you? I'll tell you. These guys are out to get me. And you relax. What are your enemies today? Health issues, financial issues, grumpy issues, emotional issues, mental issues. What are your enemies today? You have obtained grace. You have obtained favor. You have the love of God. And what He wants you to do is that very thing of being an Esther and go to that place of rest. Right there while the enemy's standing and just totally relaxed, knowing that your King is going to take care of the situation. You don't have to battle Haman. Boo. By the way, Haman's name is a play on words. In Persian, Haman means the illustrious one, the magnificent one. He is great. In Hebrew, it's a play on words, and it means tumultuous, disturber, troublemaker. So from the world's point of view, this man was illustrious and great and magnificent. From God's point of view, he was nothing but a troublemaker. And from the queen's point of view, he's the adversary and the enemy. Who does that remind us of? The angel of light who presents himself to the world, and they all think Satan is, whoa, he's great. We're all standing around going, he's a troublemaker. He's tumultuous. He's always stirring the pot against us. He is the enemy. He's my adversary. What am I going to do? I'm going to sit down. I'll have a drink and an hors d'oeuvre. I trust my King. What are your enemies? Think about them. Sit down. Pour yourself a cup of coffee while they're surrounding you. And say, great King, here they are. I trust you. I trust you. And we say, well, I'm not in the position of being the great Esther. I'm not in the position of ruling over an empire. Let me ask you this question. If you've got enemies, how do you not know that you are not raised up for a time such as this? And it is your time to be the person who becomes at rest, who relies on rest, who trusts in God. It's your time to demonstrate the total faith that you have in God without getting flustered or disturbed and say, I'm trusting Him, so that other people will say, this person is cool. This person has got it together. This person has a God and they can totally trust Him. This is totally awesome. How do you know that this isn't a time for you to let God to overcome your enemies so that 10, 15, 20, or 30 years from now, it won't be your grandchildren confronting those same kind of enemies because you broke their back by trusting in God at this point. And they will no longer attack your children or your children's children on down and on down the list. Do you see what I'm saying? Folks, when you're frustrated, when you've got problems, everything's ganging up, take a deep breath, pour yourself a cup of coffee, get a piece of pie, relax, and tell God about it.